Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rethink Energy Podcast, where the Rethink Energy team talk about the technology behind this week's energy news. I'm your host for today, Connor Watts, our automotive and battery analyst, and I'm joined by our solar analyst, Andries van den Nut.
Hello, hello.
This week, we're going to be talking about how the demand for solar from the solar industry is going to be changing, as well as some of the maybe some of the production implications that comes with. And then we're going to be talking about how oncoming falling interest rates are going to be affecting metals markets, project financing costs, and how that's going to be affecting the raw materials industry, and therefore the renewable energy industry. Too much rambling. Andries, let's talk solar quickly. You looked at the use of solar recently within solar panels and how that's been changing. Can you just go into a bit more detail about why is solar used in solar panels and how much in the future?
The reason I'm writing this story basically comes from the Silver Institute, which produces a tracking of demand and supply of solar globally across all industries each year. And what they've done, they've released a new update to their 2024 forecast. They say that demand was 1.2 million ounces, while supply was only 1 million in 2022, 2023, and now 2024 is what they expect. And within that, photovoltaics are, they're now over 10% of demand, possibly heading towards more like 19%. So, and of course, the solar industry is growing. So this shortage, which has already driven the general silver price up by a big flat 50% in mid-2020, and it's more or less stayed there since, that could get even worse. So what I did in this article was basically I just checked the logic. I actually did some calculations myself to see if they have it right, if it makes sense, because the silver demand from the solar industry is basically silver paste that's used in the cell manufacturing step. And it depends on three things. It depends on the size of the solar industry in general, of course. It depends on also which cell types you're using within the solar industry. Some use more silver than others. And it also depends on how much silver you have to use for those more intensive cell types that are coming into play now, like heterojunction, and especially TOPCon. TOPCon isn't as intensive as heterojunction, but it's still more intense than what it's replacing, which is monoPERC, and it's the one that is seizing almost all the market share, possibly as much as 85% of global manufacturing this year, up from a minority last year. So I crunched the numbers, and I think all the number crunching should probably be left to the article. It's a pain to try and read everything out in audio form. But the conclusion I reached is that if you do 800 gigawatts of manufacturing this year, which we're certainly on track to so far, and if you have that mostly be TOPCon, with some being more intense on the silver paste use because it's heterojunction and some being less because it's monoPERC, and if you use the hopefully out-of-date a parameter of 13 milligrams per watt, then you end up with 10,000 tons of silver paste, which would be 25% of global demand instead of merely 19%. So it would push global demand up by over 10% of what the Silver Institute is forecasting, and what they're forecasting is already demand 20% bigger than supply. So that would be a big problem. But I did some double checking. And it seems like TOPCon and heterojunction and monoPERC, they've all reduced their silver paste usage. And I think they've done it reluctantly because it's the best material. And the alternatives, like getting rid of bus bars or having a really good process that can spread it more thinly, or using copper metallization, you have like it's either silver coated with copper or copper coated with silver. I actually forget off the top of my head. You know, that can reduce it by about one third, the intensity. So the Silver Institute seems to have done its sums correctly. They seem to have picked up on pretty much how big the manufacturing scale is. They did underestimate it in their previous forecasts, but so did everyone, including me, because they underestimated the scale of total solar manufacturing. But yeah, they got the scale right. They got the TOPCon prevalence and the intensity right, I assume, based on their final conclusions. So unfortunately, the conclusion here is a little bit milquetoast, because it's like, well, is the silver price going to go up? Yes. And is there going to be a shortage? Yes, but only to an extent, because it's one of those situations where the reductions in utilization of the silver is driven by the price going up. So the price can't go up too much, because then the adaptations are made. But also, the price has to go up a bit, otherwise people won't bother to make these adaptations to use fewer milligrams per watt. So I think that kind of covers everything with that. It's could have been more dramatic, but it probably will be a big topic, because even in our price tracking in the past few weeks, we've seen the silver paste price for photovoltaic specifically has gone up by, I think it was 15% or 25%. 25% in the past 11 months, 15% in the past few weeks, and that adds a few percent to total module cost. So that's that.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you mentioned that it adds a few percent to the price of a module cost, so that's basically accommodating for the further reductions in the price of polysilicon that we've been seeing. Obviously not kind of make it up entirely, and the price of modules will still be going down. But one of the problems with price forecasting is trying to take into account the current price environment and then saying, okay, how much will a further supply deficit impact the price? Because as you say, it's important for things like substitutability to be taken into account. Being able to substitute silver for copper means that it'll only realistically go so high before basically every industrial demand factor goes, you know what, never mind, because silver isn't easy to come by at the best of times. So one thing that I do actually appreciate in this is that the Silver Institute was right about things, because while you were talking about that, I was looking at a report from the Silver Institute that you mentioned in the article, and it's funded primarily by miners. And so it could very well be that I'm giving them some false credit here, but I've had issues in the past with various mineral institutes who are basically acting as advocates and trade bodies as opposed to impartial observers for a metal. I've had issues with the Copper Institute in the past when it comes to passing their information a little bit. So it's good to see that the Silver Institute is on track with regards to its kind of with regards to its future demand figures for solar. Another factor in all of this, though, particularly when it comes to precious metals, I wrote something this week with regards to how interest rates affect raw material prices, but precious metals are a particularly pertinent one, and industrial metals as well. So the logic behind that is effectively, we are in a relatively high interest rate environment compared to the last few years, and Western economies still want to see significant growth. As such, high interest rates are not conducive to that, because it makes debt more expensive. And when you make debt more expensive, less companies take out loans. It's harder to finance and to receive loans in the forms of grants or from subsidies. It's harder to receive loans from governments. And so that's there's less of that going on until interest rates are lower. We've seen quite a few projects within the mining industry and within the battery cell production industry in particular be put on hold or postponed or outright kind of cancelled, because the surprise high interest rate environment made the project utterly uneconomical. And if your project is only economical at 0% interest rates, you probably shouldn't be doing it. Just historically speaking, 0% interest rates are not normal, and so there shouldn't be any assumption of kind of going back there. But we are seeing indications of interest rates lowering. So US inflation data has functionally halved over the last year after the kind of various supply chain shocks have abated, kind of they've lessened. And so eventually, and by eventually I mean there's a nice little kind of list in the article of when the next Federal Reserve interest rate meetings are, They're likely to lower interest rates by a quarter percent to each meeting, and they're trying to get it down by about 2% this year. So they're trying to go from 5.5% as the base rate, as the Federal Reserve rate, to 3.5%. Now, the other side to interest rates is that the interest rate is the base rate, is the interest rate that the government pays on companies buying government bonds. When the interest rate lowers, this is suddenly much less attractive. And so less companies will be doing it, and they will have more money for investments into other aspects. Generally speaking, when interest rates lower, this is as a result of the former, of the just nature of interest rates and investments, it shifts investments away from government bonds and towards things like precious metals, like silver, like gold. Like the PGMs are pretty well known for it. So companies holding physical assets or other assets representing the physical commodities and increasing their demand. So the process of falling interest rates is a very gradual one in most economies. You don't go from 0 to 5.5 and you don't go from 5.5 to 3.5 just because you think it's right. You want a very gradual approach. Because if you make too wild a swing, it's about the confidence in that kind of decision-making. I think Turkey's done that a few times, and Argentina has done it many times. It's a great example of how not to handle interest rate and how not to handle fiscal policy. Monetary.
What I see in this article is you mentioned the European Central Bank very incrementally reduced its interest rate from 4.25% in increments of between 0.05% and 0.2%. Now,
that was the Chinese Central Bank.
Right.
And that has been, over the last few years, completely counter to what everybody else is doing. Because China...
Because it says in late 2019, so I would have thought that the interest rates got sort of hiked up or down because of the pandemic, but in that case not.
They were hiked up and down in the West, because we were the ones experiencing the inflation. But China just kind of went, okay, well, we're just kind of, we're going to lock everybody down, we're going to be very safe about this, but at the same time, the industrial output was just prioritized. We obviously don't have like the boots on the ground to see exactly what happened in China during 2020, but effectively China never truly experienced that kind of level of inflation that the West did. They do mess around with interest rates a little bit, but they primarily mess around with kind of longer they primarily mess around with longer time horizon interest rates as a way to mess with their monetary policy and kind of industrial investment. But also, it's industrial investment is very state tied already. So there's a question to be asked, like, how much does changing interest rates really affect kind of the country's investment when basically everything gets the go ahead and significant additional funding? I'm mostly talking for the battery industry here, but you could probably add in solar and kind of most of the new energy investment here into this. Okay, so how does that actually affect things when the government's funding it anyways?
So does this play into, like, how does this interact with the whole incident of China having huge overcapacity and flooding the world market with loads of affordable goods, even more than so than usual?
Well, that likely helped keep its inflation down, for one, because it had significant overcapacity. So in 2020, there was a pretty significant rise in the demand for consumer electronics. But that was most acutely felt in the West, where we don't manufacture any of them. We just import them from China or Japan because they do it cheaper. And then we suddenly didn't have access to global shipping lanes, or at least not kind of significant access to them anyways. And so prices were hiked. China's overcapacity just allowed it to kind of weather that storm better, which means it didn't see any inflation as a result of that, according to its official figures, which I have mentioned kind of near the end of the article. You always have to take Chinese official figures with a hint of salt. But something like interest rates are public knowledge. This is the interest rate you can get from the bank if you're an institutional lender, and that's pretty irrefutable. And you were mentioning, with regards to growth, how has its electricity usage changed?
Well, in 2023, it was something like 6.7% increase in consumption. And they break it down by domestic and primary, tertiary, and secondary industry. So you can avoid having it conflated with like air conditioning, which is due to weather changes. So 6.7% growth, if you judge it by electricity in 2023. Now, I think 2022 was, to some extent, a lockdown year. So some of that would have been due to that. But we're still seeing it as of Q1 2024. They are posting, I think, let me just fire up my LinkedIn, because I posted about it there.
If anybody's interested in following us on LinkedIn, it is just Honor Watts and Andrews Want to Know on LinkedIn as well, so you'll find the sound.
Maybe type Connor's name in and then you'll find me from him instead of trying to spell mine. Yeah, so they've got, in Q1 combined compared to Q1 of 2023, they're up 9.8%. Now, you can say you're skeptical of Chinese like GDP figures, but would they really fake the electricity figures as well? And this is 12% increase in domestic consumption, 14% in tertiary industry, 8% in secondary industry, primary industry up 10%. And the biggest category there is the secondary industry up 8%. So, you know, it looks like maybe this is just a continuation of 2023. Maybe it's rapid growth that kicked in like the past previous 12 months, not the previous 15. But I don't know. I feel like if the prices come down, then that might not actually be the best thing for a nominal GDP figure, because when something is cheaper and you pay less for it, that can actually mean you're putting less into the GDP figures. But it certainly means people want to buy more of it. And in this case, the prices are going down not because of weak demand, but because the manufacturing scale has increased so much across many different things, of course, as usual. So it looks like pretty good economic growth in China. And that must help all of their customers too, at least in some ways.
I wrote something about Antofagasta and some comments from their CEO recently. And the way that their CEO describes China right now is that it's in the business cycle of it's experienced a soft landing and is entering a period of economic growth. So, like, the business cycle is effectively every 10 years it's a bit of a recession. And there's peaks and troughs in the business cycle where there's upturns and there's downturns, pretty much kind of in the shape of a sine wave, that sort of thing.
You actually say 2023 economic growth of 4 to 5%, but then the Antofagasta CEO is saying a copper demand of 6%. You know, it kind of tracks with. There are some ways you can measure it that's actually higher than the nominal.
Yes, but one.
Anyway,
of...
sorry to jump in.
No, that's all right. It's just when it comes to kind of GDP, it measures everything in the economy. So as of right now, China's real estate growth is quite significantly harming its nominal GDP. This is relative to the last 40 years, where it was most of the country's GDP. And so China's real estate crisis is kind of affecting its international figures. But China cares quite a lot about the GDP growth because that's one of the ways it competes with America. So industrial expansion has become the new kind of... It feels as though industrial expansion has become the new real estate within the country, in that by inflating industrial expansion figures and electricity consumption, and most importantly for the world, I guess, is increasing the production of new energy technologies, solar panels, electric vehicles, hydrogen electrolyzers, it's kind of making up for the loss of real estate by doing something useful, which may also be leading to overcapacity in certain markets and preventing the West from kind of getting a foothold in its own manufacture. But that's a point for another episode of the podcast, and I think inconsequential depending on how you look at it. So
I saw some graph of the real estate investment going down and the industry investment going up, but I didn't read about it further.
I followed it mostly because it's interesting. It's not overly consequential, but the real estate story in China is very interesting from a kind of demographic perspective. So you have empty cities with no schools, it has roads and stuff, but it hasn't got supermarkets, or just how are people supposed to live there, for one. But also, nobody wants to, because there's nothing useful there. There's a massive, massive overabundance of real estate in certain areas. Anyways, I think just moving on, something important this week that a lot of people care about is Tesla's Q1 figures. Now, brace yourself here because they're not overly pretty. Its Q1 profit year over year fell 55%. Its vehicle sales didn't hit targets, neither did its revenue, and its margin fell back to within the expectations of a car company as opposed to a tech company, as I believe. It might be something like 5%, maybe 5.5% profit margins per vehicle. And because it's Tesla, the share price increased on that news, which makes no sense whatsoever by conventional stock logic of, oh, the company's just halved its profit quarter over quarter and shows little sign of stopping. But one very good thing that we heard from this piece of news is that Reuters was wrong. I was on the fence about when I wrote about it a few weeks ago, in that Reuters was claiming that Tesla was abandoning the idea of the Model 2 and the kind of cheap electric vehicle that Tesla was planning for late 2025, early 2026. And so Tesla is still pursuing it. That is very, very good news for the company. It basically just has to weather the storm and continue expanding until then. Its current year is not good by any means. It missed figures largely because of the price wars it's instigated itself, but also has participated in within China, because it cut the price of vehicles in most markets in the last week or so by an extra $2,000, like the base models and such. So, still aiming to be competitive in that regard. But the Cybertruck has been, it's called a resounding failure in most markets, because it feels as though Tesla kind of went into the trap of other automakers, where they're just assuming they have to produce SUVs for some reason, when that's really, really not the case for every market other than America.
So presumably this is more, am I right in thinking it's actually less about Tesla and more about just the Chinese managing to cut costs a lot?
That's definitely a part of it, because Tesla is at the forefront of Western manufacturers when it comes to price competition. But when you're competing in China, that doesn't matter, and China's the largest market. So, when you're competing in Europe, that increasingly matters less.
That makes me wonder what Tesla's future is, because in solar, at least, we've seen this thing where the US has successfully reshored the module and cell downstream. They haven't reshored wafer and polysilicon, and I think they're probably going to end up with polysilicon from various facilities around the world. Wafers, I think, actually from India. And then the rest is reshored fully, but at least the other bits are also outside of China. Now, what is the US? Because the US has something like a 250% tariff on fully Chinese solar modules, which is why you have so many shenanigans trying to relabel things and so on. What's going to happen with EVs? Like, why hasn't the US excluded Chinese EVs yet, or has it? Sorry if I've asked this before.
It has a significant tariff on Chinese EVs already. It's something like 25%, I want to say. But
that's actually quite small, in my opinion.
But in the world of tariffs, that's quite big. Just in the world of new energy tariffs, it isn't. It has that in combination with exclusion of Chinese products from the $7,500 IRA tax credit. So, in a way, that's a tariff, because
it's a protectionist measure.
Well, the kind of exemption from a subsidy is a tariff, fundamentally speaking, in that if all of the competitors are able to meet the $7,500 tariff, are able to meet the conditions for the $7,500 subsidy, then, and if a company has no way of doing that because it is based in China, then...
So we can kind of assume that Tesla will be kept alive within the US.
Tesla is still in quite a good position. I think the main takeaway from this at the moment here is SUVs are not the answer, and sometimes a CEO just needs to shut up. I think that's really what we should be learning from Tesla's Q1 earnings at the moment. But it's doing the right things, broadly. I say right, I don't mean that in the moral sense, I mean it in the sense of cost cutting. So it's cutting 2,700 jobs from Giga Texas, and it's cutting 400 from Germany. That's what I've seen so far. I wouldn't be surprised if it accelerates, because Tesla still has far too many people on its books, and not to the level of incumbent car companies. They have way too many people on their books for EV manufacture, and so we'll probably expect to see even more layoffs as a way to cut kind of long-term costs.
But if you look at LONGi versus Western module makers, like the manpower is, I think it's something like 1/8 the intensity in some cases in LONGi, in the Chinese giants, compared to the Western solar assemblers. And part of that is just the scale of the facilities, but partly it's just because they've just sorted themselves out a bit more,
so,
like Tesla needs to.
Yeah. What Tesla actually blamed, or what I believe Musk fairly directly blamed, is increasing demand from hybrids on kind of weak EV sales, which there is some truth to that, but it's mostly because it's a lot easier to make a hybrid with, it's easier to make a hybrid SUV than it is to make a fully electric SUV. Because we already make hybrid kind of HEV SUVs, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a plug-in hybrid. Adding a larger battery and a plug socket isn't particularly difficult. And so the cost implications relative to an HEV aren't too significant. A fully electric SUV is going to be very, very expensive. Just because of the size of the vehicle, where battery technology is right now, kind of rates of charging are incredibly important to consumers. This isn't conducive to producing such a large vehicle at this point in time, because there's two main ways that you can kind of get through a technology curve in this sense. You can go through the most expensive first, which has the highest margin, which allows you to expand volume. That's what electric vehicles have done, by and large, where Tesla started off in the ultra-luxury segment. You kind of get all the early adopters in, and then you move down market segments progressively. But it kind of skipped the SUV phase, almost. It went, or at least it should have, because technologically speaking, what I'm seeing at the moment when it comes to solid-state batteries is that companies that are struggling to kind of make an EV battery size or an EV battery capable or solid-state battery, they're moving to other industries where the form factor is significantly smaller. So they're moving to things like consumer electronics, to the batteries for drones, or other markets where they can produce smaller products which allow them to test the efficacy of what it is they're producing. And so there almost needs to be a way for these industries to meet in the middle and say, okay, the battery technology isn't there yet for an SUV, but we still need to make profit of this. We're seeing the kind of latent demand for passenger vehicles for just a hatchback or a basic sedan for electric vehicles, and have been seeing that for about a year and a bit now. Because any of them that come about in Europe, or if it's a small SUV or something like the Mini Countryman, or the reason that Hyundai is even competing within the electric vehicle industry is because it recognizes that the size of the vehicle does not need to be comedically outsized. And so there's no reason, really, for companies to be pursuing SUVs at this point in time, especially not one like the Cybertruck, which was just a horrible marketing error on Tesla's part. I feel like
And I guess the reason why companies get stuck into the wrong avenue is because there's so much design up front that you have to do. Isn't it like $1 billion of R&D spend, was it, to like design a new car?
I don't want to know, but I think it was a little bit of kind of, it was a bit of groupthink, I think, here from Tesla, because SUVs have been what has been being sold in America. There's been a massive, massive uptick in people purchasing SUVs relative to sedans or coupes, or hatchbacks or or estates even, they seem to have completely died off. And so that was kind of, oh, this is a significant market segment where margins are quite high. We should be targeting this with EVs. But that the logic wasn't sound, because when you do that with an EV, you need a massive battery. And with where battery costs are right now, that's not realistic. You're not going to be able to produce an SUV to price parity with an internal combustion engine vehicle. So what exactly is the solution? You skip SUVs. You go to vehicles where you can put a smaller battery in place, you increase volume, and you return to SUVs at a later date. Because as of right now, it just isn't profitable. And the problem with this is, when you've already committed to SUVs, you kind of have to put one out and then go to other things. Or you have to develop them concurrently, and then the R&D is not split, but you need to spend more on two product lines, neither of which are being sold. So the expense part of the equation then ramps up. It was just a tactical misstep from Tesla, but it can recover from it quite easily, I think. It just needs to focus on the Model 2, and then on robotaxis. Because the Model 2 is its avenue into these kind of simpler markets, where margin will still be quite low if it wants to compete with Chinese companies, which it will. But its volume manufacturing will be significantly higher, and its revenues should jump fairly considerably. I think that'll be enough on Tesla, and likely enough for this episode. You'll find these stories and more on our website, which is rethinkresearch.biz, that's .biz, and you hit energy and you scroll down a tad and you're there. We'd like to thank you all for listening, and we'd like to see you all again next week. Goodbye for now.